On this episode of Skeptico, science journalist Jeff Wise tackles near-death experience research.
When we turn to science journalism, there's a different code, and the code is applied with this invisible hand, and that is that you're going to stick to this line, and you're not going to venture out and say other things that do point to the spiritual aspects and all that, but you're not even going to go there because you're going to be viewed as being unscientific. And it's such a contradiction because in this case, the science really points the other direction.
It's not that I'm afraid to look into it, but it doesn't really fit into my schema for how I basically have come to conclude the world works. It's a very interesting question to me, why we find something interesting. I think the answer to that question is that we're interested in things that make sense in the context of everything else that we know, but that's novel. It's new. So it has to. So things that are boring that we see every day, we're not interested in. Things that completely don't make any sense, or we have to completely deconstruct our entire worldview in order to incorporate them. Those things also aren't interesting.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we're going to dig behind the headlines. Here's the headline that grabbed my attention. Study links carbon dioxide to near-death experiences. Here's how National Geographic ran it. Near-death experiences explained. And here's how a lot of folks covered it. This was from richarddawkins.net. Near-death experience, that in quotes, explained by carbon dioxide. So you may be wondering, what's the study? What's the story behind this headline? So we're going to look at this study, but then we're going to shift our focus to how the media covered it. And for that, I'm going to be joined by Jeff Wise, a science journalist who really didn't have much of a stake in this story either way. Not like Dawkins, who you knew was going to spin it a particular way. This guy just approached it like I think most of the science media did. And the way he approached it, the way he covered it, the way he thinks about it, I think is very revealing and says a lot to a lot of the topics we talk about here on Skeptico. So here's the actual research behind this. And this was done by a group of Slovenian doctors who took a survey that Dr. Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia, a prominent near-death experience researcher, they took his survey and they translated it into Slovenian, and they gave it to these patients who had been admitted to the emergency room after they'd been resuscitated after experiencing a cardiac arrest. So what they did is they took a blood sample and they ran various tests on their blood, and then they took a survey of their near-death experience and they tried to correlate this data. They looked at about 50 folks, 11 of them had a near-death experience, and then they looked at their blood and compared it with the blood of the folks who didn't have the near-death experience. Well, they found that the 11 folks who had a near-death experience had a slightly elevated level of CO2 in their blood compared to the folks who didn't have a near-death experience. So that's what they're alluding to in those headlines. But if you really look into this study, a couple of questions immediately jump out at you. The first one, the big one, is Dawkins right? Is near-death experience really caused by higher levels of CO2? Well, the study doesn't say that. The study is very careful to say that just because they found this correlation, it doesn't necessarily suggest that that's the cause of near-death experience. Hey, but maybe it is, right? Let's look even further into this study. First, the study was small. Remember I said that they looked at 11 people who had a near-death experience. If you remember a couple episodes back, we talked to Dr. Jeff Long. He surveyed 1,300 near-death experiencers. Okay, but small doesn't necessarily mean that we should throw it out altogether. Let's look at how sure the researchers are of their findings, how statistically significant the study is. Well, as Dr. Bruce Grayson points out, using the means that we normally do, this study doesn't even meet the minimum standards of statistical significance. And I've provided in the show notes a link to exactly his analysis on that. So here we have a small study, it's barely, if at all, statistically significant. Well, what about other research that might corroborate this? Well, that doesn't fit either. In fact, again, Dr. Grayson points out that this contradicts prior research. I mean, elevated CO2 levels in the blood is something that has been looked at before by near-death experiencers, and they didn't find any correlation, and they certainly didn't find anything that suggested causation. And then if you really read the research, you'll find that the researchers themselves are very tentative in making any kind of conclusions or even in trumpeting their research very much. And they also point out that their research pushes the limits of what we understand about human consciousness. That sounds very much in line with what other near-death experience researchers have found. So how did this research get so badly misreported? That's the topic I really wanted to explore with today's guest, Jeff Wise. We're joined today by Jeff Wise, a journalist, science writer for such publications as Popular Mechanics, the New York Times Magazine, Popular Science, and many others. And he's also the author of Extreme Fear, The Science of Your Mind in Danger. Jeff, thank you for joining me today on Skeptico.
My pleasure.
Well, your book sounds fascinating, and I hope we have a chance to chat about it a little bit. I'm sure we will. But as you know, the main reason I wanted to have you on today was to discuss a recent blog post of yours on the Psychology Today website, which I have to mention is also where my wife blogs, Joni Johnston. So I was kind of cruising through there and ran across this. But
right.
Anyways, your post of April 16th was on some near-death experience research that has received a remarkable amount of press coverage, and it has to do with this group of Slovenian doctors who found a correlation between the levels of CO2 in the blood of certain near-death experiencers and the likelihood that they would report a near-death experience.
Right.
So I thought we'd talk a little bit about that, and in particular, you know, the how and why you reported on this story and how the media deals with near-death experience.
Right, sure.
So here's where I thought we'd start. Why don't I start with a quote from your blog post?
Okay.
Again, this is of April 16th. You write, "To those of a certain mindset, near-death experiences are supernatural phenomena, an early glimpse of the afterlife. To those of a more materialistic persuasion, these sensations must be generated by some common brain architecture that gets activated under intense stress. As it happens, this later view has just received some intriguing scientific backing in the form of a paper in the latest issue of the Journal of Critical Care. The key component of NDEs, it appears, is carbon dioxide in the blood. Yes, the same thing that makes Cokes fizzy also makes your life flash in front of your eyes." And I love the little twist at the end there, but tell us a little bit about how you approached this story and how you found this research.
Well, I can't remember exactly how I came across it. You know, I read a lot of science stuff on the internet, and you know, definitely caught my eye. In writing the book, I was sort of gathering string for a long time about all different kinds of ways that we respond to intense danger. And because it was, you know, the interesting question for me was, what makes up this experience when our life is at risk? And I'd done a lot of adventure, travel, and extreme sports kinds of things, and I'd noticed that when you're, say, on the edge of a bungee bridge, or you know, if you're on a plane that's doing aerobatics, your mind seems to get taken over by this, almost feels like an external force. And you know, you can rationally tell yourself, well, I'm not in any actual danger of dying or getting injured, and yet I can't help, my heart is pounding, my palms are sweating, and there's nothing I can rationally do will change that. And so I was particularly interested in how people who are in mortal danger can think creatively, because one of the symptoms of being incredibly afraid is that the part of your brain that, you know, executes rational decision-making and creativity tends to get shut down.
You know, that's fascinating, and that kind of ties into what I wanted to talk about in this research. You're right on target, and I thought it was so interesting because, one, this NDE research was widely reported, and I'm glad that you reported on it, and in particular with your background and with the book, Extreme Fear, there's some interesting tie-ins. But here's the real problem I have with it, is that all those things you're talking about are great and wonderful. They just don't relate to near-death experience. I mean, there's several problems with this research. I mean, first of all, it's relatively small. It's a small little study.
Oh, granted.
The correlation isn't that strong.
Right.
It contradicts earlier research that looked at CO2 in the blood.
Okay.
But here's the real kicker, and it's what relates to, again, the work that you've done and both in your personal experience in adventure travel
right.
and about your book.
Right.
And that's that the media has this perception that the near-death experience is about hallucination.
Right.
It's about all these experiences or all these symptoms that are associated with lack of oxygen in the blood, which
right.
is what this research is really about. The elevated CO2 levels are really a byproduct of not getting enough oxygen in the blood, as you point out quite correctly in your blog. Well, if you look at near-death experience research, which is well established now for 20 years,
right.
what we find is exactly the opposite. People who have a near-death experience have an increased level of lucidity, an increased level of awareness. You know, the most recent research that we reported on here, where they interviewed extensively 1,000 near-death experiencers, 76% of them said that their experience during the near-death experience was more conscious than their everyday life.
Right.
And the data that they report is not hallucinatory at all. 98% of the data that they report is realistic and real.
Right.
So if you have a dream and you see, you know, you're in a car and then suddenly the car turns into a lion or,
yeah.
and it's, you know, these are hallucinations. These
right.
things don't occur in the near-death experience.
So, I mean, I sense that there's an issue here that's bothering you, which is that my report and many of the reports in the media took an essentially materialistic view
all
of the
reports.
Phenomenon.
All the reports in the media.
So,
and it wasn't that hard to really find. I mean, if you look at one step beyond, or the first step of good reporting is, you know, what do the experts in the field say? Hey, the near-death experience research experts, the people like Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia or Dr. Jeffrey Long at the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation, they were quick to kind of deal with this. And they did it in a nice way, but they said there's nothing here.
Okay.
You know, it contradicts earlier studies. It's very small. And the main point is we've already looked at cerebral hypoxia, which is what this is all about.
Okay.
And there isn't anything there.
Right.
This thing just explodes in the media
right.
because it taps into, I think, what a lot of folks want to believe, which is that our consciousness is totally tied to our brain and
right.
it's totally tied to fear, which is the other thing this is tapping into, is that it's a fear of death thing. That's totally been debunked and refuted, but that, you know, persists.
Right. Well, you know, there's a huge. I mean, I see. That your trouble with this and with my reporting is really has to do with the interface between two kind of conflicting worldviews. On the one hand, and stop me if I'm completely off base here, but on the one hand, you've got the view of the human spirit as a kind of an essential thing that is sort of not rooted in an underlying physical mechanism that can be explained in strictly material terms. On the other hand, you have this kind of, you know, I don't want to say post-enlightenment, but, well, why not? Let's call it post-enlightenment. This idea that, like, the world can be kind of understood, you know, as a system of interacting particles and forces, and that, you know, so the psychology, particularly in the last, I don't know, 20 or 30 years, you know, post, you know, since the downfall of Freud, essentially has been an attempt to find mechanical corollaries to every aspect of human consciousness. And so I will plead guilty. I mean, essentially you and I are coming at this issue from different camps, I think. Whereas because I'm perceiving that you are maybe someone's human soul is an immortal essence.
I like to take all that stuff out of it, and because I think that, you know, the philosophical implications and the lack of kind of a theoretical basis for how consciousness could survive bodily death
right.
is wide open. It opens up a million questions. But I think the starting point has to be with how do we do good science? And how do we do good science reporting? And I'm not trying to call, you out here, because you write a blog every day for Psychology Today.
Right.
This obviously tapped into a lot of the topics that you're interested in, and you didn't handle it. You handled it better than most of the people that I read about.
Right.
But there's this huge disconnect here between the science media and, to a certain extent, the general population.
Right.
In terms of just the published data.
Okay.
Forget any beliefs that I have or anything like that. Just the published data, like I just told you, says that near-death experiences, one, are non-hallucinatory.
Okay.
And they're always perceived as being hallucinatory. And there's this link that's made. And it is so pronounced that I just have to wonder if there isn't something more going on, just in terms of the need for our society to reinforce and kind of prop up this hardline materialism, even when the data doesn't support it.
Well, I don't know. Is our society hardline materialistic? I mean, I
our science is, right? Because that's the disconnect, right? The general population hears about near-death experience and on Oprah or wherever, and they're like, wow, you know, that's really cool. That really relates. I know my uncle did that. But when they turn to science, what they get is just the opposite.
Yeah.
No. It's right around the corner. Oh, here it is. This will probably explain it. Just let it play itself out. Here it is, you know. And it's just not true.
This idea that a scientific theory is something that, you know, tries to increase our understanding by proposing, you know, making a prediction by saying, okay, well, we're going to say that, you know, the Earth is orbits around the sun, therefore we would expect to see this motion of the planets or something like that. What's really, I think, the thing that's often overlooked is that a theory requires a mechanism. And this is why Freud ultimately, I think, was cast aside, because Freud had a lot of interesting ideas and suppositions about how the brain worked, but he never offered any mechanisms. And so we're entering an age, and I think what you're saying is true, is that more and more you're seeing a materialistic, mechanistic view of human psychology coming to the fore, which is very much out of sync, I think, with the popular culture.
But it's out of sync with popular physics. I mean, quantum physics, which is what runs your TV and your GPS system and all that, they don't even have any kind of sense of materialism. I mean, it's so long gone from that it doesn't. But that's a whole other topic.
Yeah.
As is Freud, which I would have to interject because it's kind of a hot button for me. I mean,
oh, really?
I think we moved away from Freud because he was completely discredited as a fraud. I mean, he published fraudulent research for patients that he never really saw. And if that work was done today, we wouldn't even be so delicate in parsing, you know, why and how, you know, his theories might not hold up. We just say he's a fraud. We shouldn't follow. We shouldn't take seriously anything he said.
You know, I recently ran across a statement by somebody who's writing about science and said, you know, we need to keep politics out of science. And that struck me as funny, because to me, science in a way is politics. An idea doesn't become accepted because on its own merits. It becomes accepted because people form consensus about it. And I think what you're talking about here regarding to near-death experiences is that you feel that on a scientific forum, your view of it is in the minority, and that you're not getting a fair shake. You feel like your research is not given its due. And, you know, in a way, it's just like...
Let me fine-tune that there. And I appreciate you playing this out for me, because I realize, you know, this is not exactly where you're coming from or where you've gone on it.
Right.
A couple episodes back, I interviewed Dr. Jeff Long, the guy who published the most comprehensive near-death experience research to date.
Uh-huh.
Hey, his book shot to the New York Times bestseller list within 8 days of publication. So we can't say that there's this massive conspiracy to hold back this information. No, it's out there.
Right.
What I notice, and what I was trying to just dialogue with you a little bit about, is that when we turn to science and we turn to science journalism, there's a different code, and the code is applied with this invisible hand, and that is that you're going to stick to this line, and you're not going to venture out and say these other things that do point to all those spiritual aspects and all that, but you're not even going to go there because you're going to be viewed as being unscientific. And it's such a contradiction because, as I pointed out, in this case, the science really points the other direction.
You know, I that's not what it feels like from my perspective. I mean, to me, it feels like, look, I near-death experience is something that I'm interested in. As I started to say earlier, you know, I've been gathering string on various phenomena related to mortal danger. And it's one, you know, I put in my blog, like, I've never experienced my life flashing in front of me, and I'm not really even sure what it's like. You know, is it like watching a movie? Is it like watching a slideshow? But at any rate, it's interesting to me, but I've only tangentially touched on it. So basically, you're talking to a guy who ran across this study, tried to tie it into what he already knew about carbon dioxide levels in the blood and panic and so forth. So I don't know this other research that you're talking about, but when you mention these guys who claim that, you know, I guess they found evidence that, you know, that near-death experiences cannot be explained through materialistic explanations and so forth. It's not that I'm afraid to look into it, but it doesn't really fit into my schema for how I basically have come to conclude the world works. So it's not fear so much as kind of it doesn't really mesh into how I believe the world fundamentally works. And I think that's really the problem. If you're trying to propose a theory or a view of a phenomenon that is radically at odds with how, let's say, mainstream science views the operation of the world, you know, not to say it's impossible. I mean, that's how real, profound revolutions take place.
Hold on, Jeff, because I think you were going one direction where I'd completely agree with you, and that is that when we propose things in science that go against our observed world,
right,
our five senses,
right,
I think it makes us uncomfortable. And I think that's what you're alluding to. At the same time, that's the challenge of the times we live in, and the challenge of the science reporter is virtually all science at this point goes beyond what we experience in the world.
Right.
Everything since Einstein,
yeah,
contradicts our experiential existence, right? So the whole I still don't understand how time can be nonlinear. You know, I mean, time to me is linear.
Absolutely.
There was yesterday, today, and there's tomorrow. But I have to accept that theoretically, you know, time is not linear, and that time and space have this relationship that I don't understand. The same is true with consciousness. The data's in, it's clear, it's unambiguous, in some way that we don't understand, because we don't really even understand consciousness. We don't understand it at all.
Yeah.
But in some way we don't understand, consciousness survives death. I can say I don't understand that, I don't know that, but I can look at the data scientifically and say, yep, that's what the data says.
I think that's perhaps where I would part ways with you.
Is that the data doesn't say that?
I mean, I know that your listeners are probably very well acquainted with the data. So I don't want to like discuss whether the data is legitimate or not, but to sort of explain, you know, from my point of view, I mean, I think you wanted to talk to me to sort of talk to somebody who is on the other side of this debate and kind of get a sense of why.
No, well, I do that all the time. I talk to all the researchers who are on the other side of it. So
right.
No, I appreciate everything you said already. What I really want to tap into is, as a science reporter, how you deal with it. And you've done a fair job of that. I hear you. You're saying it doesn't fit with your worldview, and therefore the data would be a huge leap. You can't dig into every topic that you come across. So you basically have to stick with what's the kind of commonly accepted view of things.
Not what's commonly accepted, but what's accepted by me. You know, when we approach the world, it's a very interesting question to me, why we find something interesting. We're filled with, you know, of all the things that we could, you know, look at, turn our attention to, listen to, think about, we selectively narrow it down to a very small subset. And I think the answer to that question is that we're interested in things that make sense in the context of everything else that we know, but that's novel. It's new. So things that are boring that we see every day, we're not interested in. Things that completely don't make any sense, or we can't possibly, we have to completely deconstruct our entire worldview in order to incorporate them, those things also aren't interesting.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And so, I mean, look, if it turned out that the Earth was hollow, that would be mind-blowingly incredible and would be great. I mean, like when I saw like the lakes of methane on Titan, that to me is mind-blowing. Why is it mind-blowing? I don't know. There'd never been like a pool of liquid I've seen on another you know, celestial body. And to, you know, to see the pictures of Titan, that to me is the coolest thing in the world. So I love the idea of having your world like incredibly enriched by seeing something by having knowledge unveiled to you.
What I hear you saying though is, and I think you're right, big steps are a lot more difficult. And if they conflict with our worldview, we're less likely to be interested in making that leap and making that step, unless we personally encounter it.
Right.
So people who have a near-death experience, obviously, or have friends or relatives who do, then they might go there. But otherwise, people are like, my world works fine just the way it is. I'd rather not hear your data. So
right. Well, you know, there's that old saying in science, but like extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. But I think you're probably frustrated because I think you're probably talking to a lot of people who are saying, you know, I don't even want to hear about it. You're telling me that consciousness survives death. That's a huge thing for a lot of people to accept, because that would mean, well, I mean, you know what it means. It means
right for science. It's a whole game changer, and that's why I think sciences and science journalists are kind of resistant to go there. It's not in their zone, and why?
But at the same time, you know, you're playing on you're sort of on the edges. I feel of kind of the most interesting field in science, and probably I think in the next century, like the ultimate most fascinating and rich area of scientific inquiry, which is, you know, what they call in artificial intelligence circles the hard problem, which is how do you reconcile our subjective experience of the world, this consciousness. You know, we all feel that we have a soul. I mean, I feel like I have a soul. I, you know, when I'm scared, I feel very much like I have a soul that's at risk and I want to keep it alive. And how do I reconcile that with a strictly mechanistic worldview? And that's to me, you know, I talk about methane lakes on Titan. That to me is a question which will blow everyone's mind if and when it ever gets figured out in sort of an Einstein-level way. Or maybe it's more profound. I mean, but there have been a lot of thinkers who have said this problem will never get solved. It's fundamentally impossible to reconcile a materialistic approach to the universe with our own subjective experience. You know, my subjective experience will always remain entirely with a singular experience that no one else can ever have an insight into. And that's not entirely dissimilar from your interest in the soul that survives death.
Again, though, it's funny in a way that loops back to the post and the research. And if you really deconstruct it in normal ways that we can look at and analyze that we could probably both agree with, this is a clunky bit of research. It didn't deserve the attention it got. And now you Google the amount of news agencies that picked it up and reported it. It's extraordinary. I mean, it's way over the top. So that's where I was really getting at.
A lot of the research falls guilty of that. I completely agree with you. You get an awful lot of research that has totally small sample sizes, very weak correlation, could be completely wrong. A lot of stuff comes over the transom that will not stand the test of time.
Yeah, it's a big gap to bridge there. I understand the problem.
But, you know, you're also trying to bridge a gap. The more sophisticated science becomes, the more advanced it becomes. As you mentioned with Einstein, that was 1905. I mean, how far we've come since then, the more progress science makes, the further it becomes removed from the common man's idea of how the world works.
Right.
And so no one knows, nobody on the street knows how quantum mechanics works. I don't. And, you know, you look at some of these mathematical concepts that are being used to explain, you know, the universe is potentially a 2D hologram that generates the four-dimensional space-time. I mean, it's mind-boggling where these sort of benighted intermediaries between these incredibly far-off and outer space thinkers and the common man who hasn't really come any further since, you know, 1800 AD. So it's a very difficult job, and it's important. I mean, it really matters, I think, whether people believe that the soul is a, you know, epiphenomenon of materialistic brain function or whether it's, you know, comes from God. And It's not something that's ever going to be resolved in a scientific forum. It's a cultural, it's a political.
I'm with you at the first part of that, but I don't think we can throw up our arms and say it's non-scientific or we can't address it. In the same way that we look at this research and we can say whether it's good or bad, and I'm not asking you to agree with whether it's good or bad, but the same tools that we use to analyze it, the scientific method, are the same tools that we can apply to that other question.
But you're assuming that the science issue will be resolved and that will then trickle down to the public, who will then accept it.
Well, the public has already accepted it.
Oh, you just said that most people don't think of it in the way that the scientists do. That most people take that sort of Oprah Winfrey view of the soul as surviving death.
Well, but here's the disconnect. The best scientists in the near-death experience field are congruent with the Oprah crowd. The disconnect is the other part of the scientific community that has bought into this idea that materialism has to underpin science.
Right.
And it doesn't, of course. What has to underpin science is a scientific method. That's all that matters. You know, science is a method. It's not a position. It's not political. The whole idea, you know, you're saying the way that science is constituted and works in our society is very political. But the whole idea of science was to be apolitical and to avoid the biases that we naturally have. Of course, that's impossible. You know, that was the goal originally.
Do you consider yourself a creationist?
No, not by any means.
Okay.
And I don't even think that's irrelevant. What's kind of most central to this issue is, why can't we get to the data? Why, even as with the last part of what you said,
right,
why do we get to some point and say, you know what, science can't penetrate that question?
Right.
Well, of course science can penetrate
that
question.
Right.
This fellow in Slovenia, what he did was translate the survey that Dr. Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia has used for a long time to look at near-death experience, and he gave that survey to these people who came in that had a cardiac arrest.
Right.
And he analyzed it in the same way that Grayson did.
Right.
Well, great. Well, let's go look at Grayson's work then. Let's go look at Jeffrey Long's work, who used the same survey, and let's correlate the data across all three of those studies. I mean, that's solid science. When you do that, the picture that emerges is what I said, is that the characteristics that you see are not what's being reported. So it isn't really that hard to penetrate these questions scientifically. What's hard is to move the whole mechanism, the institution of science, and to tilt it a little bit is turning the Titanic kind of thing.
Well, it's an endlessly fascinating question, and it's really interesting for me to talk about it and to think about it.
Well, it's very interesting, and I appreciate you kind of digging into this. You were the perfect guy, Jeff, the extreme fear guy.
Right.
Was the perfect guy to report on this, and I'm really glad you did.
Any of your listeners want to check out the blog, or I have another blog that's called jeffwise.wordpress.com, that I put up for the book. I am very interested to hear what the experience of these things is like, and I've already had some people writing in and talking about what they saw. And the descriptions that I've gotten so far are definitely up your alley, where it seemed to be something that was not mechanistically explainable. It's something that I don't begin to understand what's really happening here, but I'm very interested in what it feels like.
Well, thanks for posting that blog entry, and thanks for appearing on Skeptico today.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thanks again to Jeff for joining me today on Skeptico. If you'd like to check out his blog or some of the links that I mentioned in this show, in particular my wife's link at Psychology Today blog, I know you're going to want to check that out. But if you want any of those links, come to our website. It's at skeptico.com. That's SKEPTIKO. Remember, it's a K. And when you get there, you'll find all these links to our previous shows, a link to our forum where you can exchange ideas with other folks, a Facebook link to me, an email link to me, everything you're going to need to learn about Skeptico. So coming up on Skeptico, I have a couple of interesting shows, and we're actually going to return to this topic again because I think it's interesting and there's a couple other angles on it I'd like to explore, so stay with me for that. Until then, take care. Bye for now.